Never mind the bollocks. It's the Jack Mangan Deadpan Podcast. I am your host, Jack Mangan, a.k.a. Radic Bonk. He's a hockey player, by the way. Is that too obscure? Okay, then, a.k.a. one of the Hanson brothers in Slapshot. We're starting the show off with hockey references because the interview is none other than John Buccigross, famous of ESPN and ESPN.com. That's in addition to the usual deadpan wackiness and zaniness. Up first, however, I have this quick note from the lovely and talented Chris Fisher.
You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast, in case you hadn't realized it. This is Chris the Fixed Kitty, also the voice of Lady Macbeth the Quasar, in Jack's upcoming patio book, Dirk Moonfire and the Nefarious Space Women. I don't sound like this in the patio book. I also don't sound like this in my show, the Adult Space Child-Free Podcast at www.gettingby.net, where I discuss child-free issues and rant against the excessive child-proofing and child invasion of the rest of the world that isn't specifically a child space, to the detriment of free speech and general manners. I talk more about it, but then I might lose this deadpan tone. Deadpan. It makes me wonder. Cooking in regular pans ensures that the food and any microbes in it are dead. That's the basic evolutionary advantage of cooking, after all. Would cooking in deadpans make the resulting food and its microbes undead? Is there a creepy speculative fiction waiting to be written, possibly by Jack, on this strange theme? Damn, I'd better stop. The deadpan is slipping. And now, your deadpan host, Jack Mangan.
And thanks for that, Chris. Yes, she did, in fact, do a great job as the evil Lady Macbeth the Quasar in Dirk Moonfire and the Nefarious Space Woman, which will be available soon at patiobooks.com. Sorry, I don't have a release date right now. Since I'm plugging that, I'll just tell you the only other stuff I can plug is should be up soon at sfreader.com, my short story 16 Pieces at a Time, which took third place. Go me. And the Spherical Tomy print chapbook should be out very soon. It's not out yet, but stay tuned to www.jackmangan.com for all the news about my upcoming releases. Boy, I've really got to stop talking like Captain Kirk or like superheroes. Huh? There's so many dramatic pauses between my words as I think of the next thing to say. All right, enough of that. Damn it, Jim, I'm an author, not a podcaster.
Getting a leg up. Shake out the blue sound of the shogun. Shake out the blue sound of the shogun rains through blue waves. Rains. Getting a leg up brings you the sounds that you need. The sounds that you want. The sounds that you desire. Getting a leg up. Brooklyn bluesman. Reigning shogun of Taiwan. The blue shogun. Yeah.
Hey, there's the stolen rap hip-hop lines music. This is a pretty cool one, because this is actually a request. Yes, I've gotten a request. So, thanks for the request to Mr. and Mrs. DeMoro. And this one's going out to you guys. It's from maybe one of the best rap songs of the 2000s. You probably heard it from Jay-Z, 99 Problems. Just be warned, the lyrics aren't rated R, but PG-13. I don't know what you take me as or understand the intelligence that Jay-Z has. I'm from rags to riches, niggas, I ain't dumb. Got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me. 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. If you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Hit me. Okay, I know that was awesome, but the Jay-Z version is actually much better, so make sure that you buy his album or at least download the song from iTunes. If you want to request a song for stolen rap hip-hop lines, then feel free to email me at jack@jackmangan.com. And if I've heard the song and I'm familiar with it, then I'll bust it out. Word.
Hey, this is Mike Nelson, and you're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. K Keep it tuned here.
Okay, so the Zambonis have smoothed out the ice surface, and we're ready for the interview with John Butchergross of ESPN. Even if you're not that interested in sports, go ahead and give a listen, because it's a pretty entertaining interview, and he's a funny guy. After that, we're going to follow up with a dumbass memory and some original music. Sound the interview gong.
Those of you listening may or may not be sports fans, but you'll want to check out the interview with my next guest. He's an expert with baby names, owner of an otter named Ken, an expert on good non-top 40 music, a friend of Barry Melrose and his hair, and oh yeah, he's an on-air personality and hockey columnist for ESPN. It's John Butchergross. Thanks so much for being on the show, John.
No problem.
So tell my listeners a little bit about you, a little bit about where you come from and how you got where you are right now.
Well, I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Lived in Pennsylvania for 11 years, Ohio for 11 years. Graduated from Heidelberg College in that 22nd year. And then moved to New England to start my hopeful television career. I always wanted to, once I hit teenager age, I kind of had my eye on Boston. I enjoyed the city and the historical aspect. I had a lot of family. Okay. We were the only ones who were in the Midwest. So I always had my eye on there, and I knew from a very young age what I wanted to do. I always loved music and sports, so I would play. Parents gave me a tape recorder when I was 12. I would turn the sound down on the TV and broadcast games of all sports. And then when I had two tape recorders, then I had my own radio station where I could play music on one and tape the show on the other. And okay. So I did a lot of DJing and stuff like that, and went to college for it, and luckily got a job about a year after college, and then slowly worked my way up to ESPN.
Oh, that's great. And then what was your first year at ESPN?
My first year at ESPN, I was hired October 26th, 1996.
Okay. Wow, then I do remember you from the beginning. I didn't know if you'd been around longer than that.
Yeah, ESPN News started November 1st, 1996, and lucky for me, usually ESPN hired maybe a person a year, maybe a person every 18 months, because all they had was SportsCenter. Then they had ESPN2, so they hired about four or five people. That was the Reese Davis, Susie Culver, Stuart Scott, Bill Pito group. So there's a little bit of four or five, and then when they started ESPN News, they needed, again, another 10 to 15 anchors. So that enabled me to get my foot in the door with that kind of mass hiring. For ESPN, it was mass hiring, 10 people. So that enabled me to get in there, and then eventually my role expanded to hockey 2 years later, and then sports centers, and then my column in 2001.
Okay. Now, I was going to say, you've done a lot. You and Barry Melrose and the NHL Tonight crew did a lot for hockey at ESPN. I mean, I do remember the Tom Meese days as well. But
Tom passed away the summer before I got there.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's that is a shame.
Yeah.
I have a lot of great memories about Tom Meese covering the NHL. But now, what I meant to ask was that a lot of you, or was that a lot of the suits and the executives saying, okay, well, we're going to go with hockey, and you guys are the team?
Well, no, that once they started ESPN2, I believe. I'm not quite sure the year. It was around 94-ish, I believe. When they thought about doing this hockey show, I wasn't there. I was in Providence, Rhode Island. But the lockout hit, so there really wasn't right. Anything to do. And then once the lockout was over in January of 95, that's when NHL Tonight went on the air with Bill Pito and Barry Melrose. Mm-hmm. Melrose had just been fired by the Kings, filled in the previous Stanley Cup playoffs on ESPN as an in-between period host, and then once they had this idea of doing all these Tonight shows on ESPN2, RPM Tonight, NBA Tonight, Baseball Tonight, NHL right. Tonight, then that's when the show started. Like I said, Bill Pito did it first, and he did it for a number of years, and then when I got hired, like I said, in 96, I filled in, actually it was the playoffs of 98. It took me about a year and a half before. I'm not real good at promoting myself or letting people know that I have a pretty good hockey knowledge or passion for it. But Bill just didn't have a big interest in hockey. And I grew up with the sport because my dad's from Boston. He grew up listening to Boston Bruins on the radio in the 70s. So I had a pretty good passion for hockey, and a good historical base. So once I got in the show as a fill-in, people go, wow, they really enjoyed my enthusiasm for the sport and my knowledge. I think other people pushed me more than I did.
I was
named host in the fall of 98.
Now, you actually replaced Bill Pito because he was caught using an illegal stick. Wasn't that the case?
Yeah. Well, not Bill.
Sorry, I guess that's it.
You might have had a legal eyeshadow.
I guess that's a touchy subject for Barry Melrose.
Exactly. Well, he takes it well. It definitely probably cost him a Stanley Cup.
Yeah. Well, now you guys really established something. I really miss NHL Tonight, and you guys really established such a great little thing. And it's obvious with the feedback you get on your column for ESPN. And I guess I want to ask, when do you think people first started to notice, like, hey, you know, this guy has the funniest comments when he's just covering hockey? You know, like, for example, Twisted Wrister. I mean, that's just pure genius. Now, when did that first start to really catch on? Or do you remember it really catching on?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, I think a lot of success of the show really was Barry. He's very good at what he does. He makes everybody really look good. He's such a explosive personality on the air with that laugh and that those teeth and that hair, and he's very witty. You know, he just, a lot of the athletes are witty because their minds are pretty sharp, because their whole career was about cutting the next guy up and try to get a good comeback, and that really sharpens your brain. So Barry's very good at that. So I think a lot of success was him, and I just try to always make him look good and set him up. He was the star, so my job was to not talk very much, set him up, let him talk more, and not be the kind of host that talks too much and tries to take over show. Just let him kind of carry it. And so I think that's why it worked. And then we got nominated for a couple of Emmys, first time in ESPN2 history that a show was nominated for an Emmy. We were the first one in back-to-back years. So that was, but again, I think that's largely because of Barry.
He was absolutely great, yeah. And, you know, he was very distinctive TV personality, you know, with the suits and the hair and just his personality. But I do have to give credit where it's due, though. I mean, all your catchphrases and your wit and your personality, and, you know, like I said, Twisted Wrister, the fact that you would invoke an old Weird Al video saying, yo, ding, dong, yo, when someone hit the post.
That was probably the most popular one. Yeah, for those who got it. And you see, my philosophy on humor is to entertain 14 people a whole bunch instead of a million halfway. So when I say, yo, ding, dong, yo, again, probably a half of a 1% got that. But those who did really enjoyed it. So I enjoy that, doing that, more than doing a joke. I mean, everybody gets, but just, you know, enjoys it halfway.
Right. I guess, can you tell people out there a little bit about Ken the Otter, speaking of your, you know, your humor and your shtick?
Well, I was writing a column a few years ago, I do kind of strange non sequiturs, I always have, and I think I was answering a female writer's question, and then towards the end of it, I just mentioned I also have an otter named Ken, and you know, I think I might have been driving in the car when I mentioned it, and so then it became kind of a running thing, and then after a few times, there are still people out there who really believe I have a pet otter. I mean, they're convinced I have a pet otter. Some people obviously get the joke, and other people aren't quite sure. What's the deal with, do you have an otter or not? I'm not ready to commit to whether or not you are indeed an otter owner. So it's been a lot of fun. I haven't mentioned it too much the last couple of years. I actually wrote a whole column on it once, and they wouldn't let me run it. The editors wouldn't let me run it. It was like the Legend of Ken, and I thought it was one of my best work, but they wouldn't run it.
Really? Well, I guess it doesn't have that much to do with the sports.
No, it doesn't. but it's hockey. He could be a hockey type. I would think if an otter would be a fan of any sport, it would be hockey.
Yeah, really, right.
Because they could play it. You know, the puck's on the ice. They can push the puck along. They can whack it with their tail. You know, an otter can't play basketball. An otter can't dribble.
Exactly.
An otter can't kick field goals. He can't lay down a sacrifice bunt. But he could probably, on a frozen lake, play some form of hockey with perhaps a rock or a piece of bark. You know? Did you get my drift?
Well, you know, Lou Lamoriello actually drafted an otter back in 92. The guy never made it up through the system, though.
Yeah, he wasn't long enough, apparently.
Right.
Both short-limbed.
Now, this leads actually, well, I guess it doesn't, but I'm going to go there anyway. When are you going, since your column is so well-written and it's, you know, so engaging and it's got such a cult following. When is there going to be a Jean Butchegross, a novel or a book? When is that going to happen?
It's funny you mentioned that. I definitely want to. I get that question a lot from people, and I've never done one. So one, I'm not sure how to do it. I'm not sure if I can do it. But what I just got into discussions and I'm talking. Actually, a publisher came to me and asked me that same question. And I gave him an idea of what I wanted to do, and they wrote up a contract. So we're getting kind of close. And I want to start kind of baby steps. And so Keith Jones is a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Used to play for the Flyers and the Avalanche. He has a really, really eclectic group of stories throughout his career that kind of fits the tone of my column. Kind of the as you termed it, non-top 40, just a little bit off the beaten path, off the mainstream kind of thinking and tone of my column. He kind of fits that. And so I've convinced him to, let's sit down and get all these stories from your career, and some are just really classic, and then I'll add my touch to it. And then we'll come up with a nice little 200-page book, an easy read, just to kind of get me going and see if I can do it. And then I have other ideas as well, whether it be a children's book, maybe with Ken the Otter. Mm-hmm. Chris Drury is a good friend of mine. I think he has a real interesting story to tell. He's one wherever he's gone. It's very interesting. Kind of make it almost like, his secrets of success while I tell his story.
Right.
And then maybe, like you said, maybe a cool little fictional novel as well. So I do have some ideas. So I think I'm going to start with Keith this summer. Hopefully it'll be out in the fall. And then see if I can do it, see if I enjoy it, see if I'm any good at it, and then we'll go from there.
Can be nice.
And that's actually breaking news. No one knows that yet. So you're the first ones. Oh. You and your audience. That's breaking news.
Well, cool. I'm glad. glad to be a part of that. But now that's going to be another hat, though. Once you start, writing for publication, and that's another thing. You're a family guy. You talk about it a lot, and it seems like you're busy because all of your kids are. You're very active with your kids. Now, how do you find time for being the ESPN columnist and everything in your life? How do you make it all fit?
Well, the TV part is pretty easy. I got to admit, it's not very difficult. I go into work. We have a meeting. Talk about what's going to be in the show. And then I sit down and watch ball games all night. and then other people look at the highlights and they give us the shot sheet and tell us what plays to run. Anytime we appear on camera, we write that. They're called lead-ins. Mm-hmm. But, I might have, on sports, and I might have three of those a show or four. So, from that standpoint, I'm still there 9 hours. So, no matter what you do, if you're not somewhere else for 9 hours, it's still a job. And there's times I work till 4 a.m. I don't enjoy that. And going to bed at 5, like last night, kind of messes up today.
Right.
The kids, I coach one-on-one hockey and I try to go to all their games and my job allows that because I don't travel at all. So I'm always home. Again, so that makes it easy. And that's always my first priority. It's the only thing I think I'm really good at is being a dad. Everything else I have to work really hard at. Nothing comes easy for me. And as far as the book thing, the column, I write 36 a year. So I do have the whole summer to maybe, work on that. And I have no problem. I'm not stressed at all though. So I'm not sure if I answered that question adequately, but I just kind of take it an hour at a time. I like to do a lot of different things and I just do them.
All right. Well, yeah, that's a good answer.
I don't require a lot of sleep either. 4 or 5 hours is really all I need. So luckily, I'm one of those people that don't really require a lot of sleep. So therefore, I'm up more, and therefore, I can get more done.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely too much sleep. That's definitely the enemy of productivity.
But even though overall, I would characterize myself as lazy. If someone, I am by no means an energetic go-getter. Like I said, nothing comes easy for me. I am by nature lazy.
Well, you definitely don't give the impression with all the stuff that you do manage to get done.
I think that's because I do most of my work at night. I write my column at 3 a.m. That's when I seem to be. I must be 4% vampire because I do have kind of funny teeth and I just do my best work at night.
Yeah, well, you're on your 10th bowl of cereal by that point, right?
I am a prodigious cereal eater. Yes.
See, I do read your column. I'm one of the faithful.
That's true. I guess you know more about me than probably I want you to know about me, but I guess it comes through in the comments.
Well, when I was watching you the other day take out the garbage, I noticed that about you too. Just kidding. Now, I guess this is, we'll do a 90 degree turn here, and let's get in. I definitely want to talk about the music before I let you go.
Sure.
So let's talk about the music. I mean, what was your, how did you become such a music buff? And it maybe, can you talk about one or two albums that were just seminal, like so important for you?
I think my parents were somewhat musical. My mom always liked to sing, and she sang in choir, church, and my dad was one of those kinds of dads who didn't mind singing. So he'd sing along to music. I mean, a lot of their stuff, they were by no means cutting edge. I mean, they were born in the 30s, but even in the 60s, they would have only been in their 30s. But they pretty much, you know, they were Nat King Cole, Bing Crosby, Perry Como. There was no cutting 60 music in my household, even though, like I said, they're in their late 30s or even the 70s as well. So I thought a lot of my music growing up was what was on the radio. You know, there was no XM. There was no, obviously, cable TV. I didn't have cable TV until I was 12. So the only means of music really were what was on the radio, and that was mainly Top 40. But obviously, I also have some sort of gene that makes me, that music has always moved me, inspired me, make me emotional, make me whatever emotion that the music is intended to force out of you. So, but then as I went through college and I get a little more enlightened, you get introduced a little more different kinds of music, then you really start to expand. And I think it's been a slow, gradual process. I don't know if it's really been a seminal album. Certainly the first time I heard REM on a train going from Charlotte to Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. first time I heard Fall on Me, that was like, whoa, this is different. And mm-hmm. so then when Joshua Tree came out, that took me to another place. And I just kind of, I've dabbled everywhere, you know, whether it be early rap with Run DMC. I was one of the first white people to buy that album. And certainly punk. I got really into punk. And so it's just, you get introduced kind of by these things, Top 40, like someone like Blondie. Mm-hmm. That's the first time a lot of people heard a rap song or any kind of punk overtones. And then you just, then you get curious and then you investigate and find more hardcore stuff around those genres. And then you really, it opens up. But I really have a huge wide variety of musical tastes. So I really still like Nat King Cole. I like AC/DC. I like The Clash. I like REM. You know, I like Pete Yorn. I like Ben Folds. I put no limitations on my music, and I feel sorry for people who do. I don't make fun of anybody's musical taste. If you like Barry Manilow, you like Barry Manilow. I'm not going to hate on you.
Good. Yeah, you don't want to be hating on those players like that.
No, not Manilow players.
Yeah, they'll bust a cap in you. Well, I mean, yeah, that's a good answer. I do harken back. I guess this is deviating a little bit, but I do harken back to the days when you could branch out from Top 40. I'd state the case now that you can't branch out from Top 40 and find the cool like REM type of stuff. I don't think that's going to happen. Or I think Top 40 now is too self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're exactly right. It is. I mean, it's the corporations that have taken over the radio stations and the limited playlist and the disc jockeys who don't have a chance to really, show their personalities and their musical tastes and their abilities to find good music. But that's what the beauty of satellite radio is. It really has been a miracle for, I believe, for music lovers. And to me, it's going to help save the music industry, and at least in terms of getting good music out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting.
You know, it's still not mainstream enough. You know, still not enough subscribers, and maybe not. You know, maybe that'll always limit it. But I still think it's a good step in the right direction. Get some good music out there.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, take care of a few things, and then get back to talking with John Butchergross for a few more minutes about hockey. So stay tuned.
I think that the problem may have been that there was a Stonehenge monument on the stage that was in danger of being crushed by a dwarf.
Dumbass Memories. This dumbass memory won't be the funniest one, but I think it serves well to illuminate a bit about me and my style. During a family get-together back in the mid-90s, my cousin from Indiana had recently graduated law school and was telling a group of us about this Indiana lawyer out there who ran his practice out of this big tacky trailer, and how he'd drive it around and pull over on corners and make flamboyant displays to gather attention. My cousin went on to talk about his own search for a law firm. So I said, as a joke, "Well, if you don't find one, you'll just have to buy your own trailer." Ha ha. Well, I guess my cousin didn't realize I was making a hilarious joke. He was mortified. He said, "No, I'd never do that." When I related this story to my girlfriend at the time, her response was, "Well, you know, sometimes your delivery is so dry, so deadpan, that other people can't always tell when you're joking." And that, ladies and gentlemen, was the first time I can recall anyone ever calling me out as a dry humor, deadpan kind of guy.
Dumbass Memories.
Hello. This is T. Morris of Podiobooks.com, the Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy, and Podcasting for Dummies. You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. Yay.
Okay. Well, now, you know what? All of your faithful are probably going crazy right now, so let's talk hockey. Now, it's been, well, actually, I don't get OLN, but they tell me it's been a great season this year.
Yeah, it's been a good season. Scoring's up a little bit. We have the greatest infusion of rookie talent ever because, obviously, we skipped a year. We had two draft classes,
right.
So that would have been the case probably anyway, but also the Ovechkin-Crosby introduction to the year.
Right.
Certainly, you're talking about Hall of Fame talent there, and Dion Phaneuf in Calgary and Henrik Lundqvist. So you have a real good infusion of young players, a faster game, a little more goals. And the game has the shootout's been really great for fans, especially the casual fan.
Right.
And I think it's been a very successful year. I'm looking forward to the postseason here. See how the new rules and how the everything, you know, how it correlates and translates to playoff hockey.
Yeah, and I'm really impressed with the referees. They really have been. I know that they've slacked a little bit, but they really have been pretty consistent, more consistent than I ever could have dreamed.
Yeah, I mean Stephen Walkham was one of my favorite referees, and he became the director of referees. He left the ice, which I thought would be a bad thing because he was young and a real good skater. He could get around and call a good game, mm-hmm. and he became the director of referees, and he was determined to introduce this new standard on the puck carrier, to use his words, that, mm-hmm. you know, that you were not going to be able to do certain things anymore, and you're going to stick to it. And talked to Chris Drury of the Buffalo Sabres a couple days ago. He'll appear in this week's column. It might be out now. I'm not sure. I just turned in this morning.
Okay.
But he was talking about how, it was good in the beginning of the year, a little bit of lull after 20 games, then they went back to it. And so he thinks that they've been pretty consistent, which is a miracle for NHL, because all those years they called it for the first week, and then they just blew it off.
Right, and I think the league tried to throw in a bunch of crazy rules to fix it, when really the solution was for the referees to call the game properly.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, I always had the analogy, it's just like football and basketball. You know, if a wide receiver runs past you, you can't reach out and grab him on the back of the shoulder and slow him down, or you can't tug the back of his shirt. Or in basketball, on a fast break, you can't reach out, just give the guy a little tug on the shoulder, just a little bit, you know, or reach up around his hip and just kind of pull him back a little bit. You can't do that. I mean, if a guy is by you, you can't touch him. And to me, that always seemed pretty obvious. And now the same thing with the stick. Why the stick should never be off the ice. The stick should always be on the ice. Certainly when you make a check, it might come up a little, but you should never be able to touch any part of the body with your stick when you have two hands on it and you intentionally poke or slash, or that shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, I agree. And it's amazing how we just took it for granted before the lockout. We just said, oh, well, that's just the way it goes. And we actually would, you know, fans would stand up and boo if that did get called.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then the Stanley Cup playoffs between, Tampa Bay and Calgary, you know, a lot of the writers were complaining it was bad. And to me, getting caught up in the drama and the history and the passion and the crowd, to me, it still looked like a good game to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I'm more emotional as opposed to analytical. So to me, I still enjoyed it when other writers said it was an awful game. It was just a big slugfest out there. And then when you look back now at the tape and say, oh, my goodness, that guy was absolutely molested away from the play. You know, he's coming down the slot. There's a stick in his gut. You know, right across his gut, almost like a toll booth, slowing him down. And now you can't do that anymore. You can't put your stick horizontal to the ice.
And it's great. I mean, the clutch and grab days are, thank God they're gone.
Yeah, it helps the smaller player and helps the faster player. And that's why teams like Buffalo and Carolina are doing so well, because they're faster, skater, smaller teams. And so, therefore, they can use their speed. Before, you couldn't. You could neutralize speed by just sticking your stick out.
Right. Now, I do disagree, though, that the trap wouldn't work. You know, I did disagree. Well, maybe it's because I'm a Devils fan, but I do always disagree that the trap was about clutch and grab. I think Jacques Lemaire's Trap was just flawlessly executed and really exciting to watch. That's I often disagree with people about that. What do you think about that?
You know, just like Minnesota, you know, they're a good skating team. They skate a lot, and yeah, they play it safe. Their idea is to, when it's out, dump the puck behind the defenseman, dump it in the corner, so you're not going to get a lot of, you know, real offensive chances out of a team like the Devils or the Wild, because they're instructed to get it deep, get it behind the defenseman, throw it behind the net, and but yeah, there's no clutch and grab. It's just a lot of skating and not a lot of offensive opportunities for them or the other team. You know, limit to both for both, and. And that's what he did in New Jersey, and that's what he did in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And because they don't have a lot of offensive talent. You know, I mean, the Devils haven't had Hall of Fame offensive talent in their franchise history, so you got to play a different way. And same with the Wild, you know.
Right.
I mean, has Brian Johnta broken the Devils' single-season record yet? He's, I know he was had a chance there for a while. He slowed down, but mm-hmm. I know he was closed in on Pat Verbeek's single-season record for most goals by a Devil. So, yeah, they have a little more this year, but... You know, but still, basically, it's one line for the Devils of producing goals and Eliash, Gomez, and Johnta, so they have to play a certain way.
And actually,
plus they had two Hall of Fame defensemen in front of a Hall of Fame goaltender. That kind of helped too.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that's something I wanted to talk to you about, and I don't want to turn this into the Devils podcast because, again, you know, you have fans from all the teams in the league. But now, since they just retired Ken Danico's number, you know that. And he's a guy, of course, I'm a huge fan of his, and of course I'm completely biased, but I want to get your take, since you talk about this in your column sometimes. You think, what do you think about him for the Hall? And feel free to plug other guys or talk about other guys in a similar vein if you want.
Yeah, no, Ken Danico is not a Hall of Famer. I mean, obviously, he fit a certain role, and he was obviously very tough. He had a great personality. He could bring a room together. But in terms of the outlet pass and shooting and skating and hailing the puck up the ice, alleviating pressure, you know, to me, Scott Niedermeyer made everybody on the Devils look a lot better than they really were. He's the true Hall of Fame talent. Certainly Scott Stevens will get in. He played a long time.
Yeah.
But he was not the player that Scott Niedermeyer was. I mean, how he could alleviate pressure, take a puck, hold on to the puck, not just dump it out off the glass or off the boards like a lot of defensemen do.
Sure.
And just hold it and then take it up the ice and then, of course, be a power play threat, carry the puck up the ice. Just an immense, immense talent. And But like I said, Stevens will get in. He was a captain. He was a leader. He was a big hitter. He set the tone. He intimidated. But I'll put those to it. But no, I think Danico's not quite there, because you put him in, there's about 100 or 200 other guys like him that you'd have to put in terms of defensemen.
Sure. Well, like I said, I'm way too biased to really look at that objectively. but now, what about stay at home? Are there stay at home guys like Ken Danico? I would love to have, if I had to choose a defenseman to be back on a 2-on-1 situation, I would love to have Ken Danico back there. I mean, now do you think there is a place in the Hall for guys like that? I mean, maybe with more skill than Danico, okay. But do you think there's a place?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's what really, you know, that's what Rod Langway was for the Capitals. And even Stevens is a stay-home defenseman. He wasn't a goal scorer. He only had one decent goal scoring year his whole career.
That's right.
And that was with the Capitals, and it was kind of skewed by a real good power play year. That will happen sometimes. The defense will have that year where everything goes in. It goes off skates, goes off of butts, goes off of everything.
I'm sorry to cut you off. So I was just going to wonder if Stevens did lead the Devils in scoring one year, though. So he did have another. He was, you know, you're right. That's not his strength, but he was
right.
Adequate.
Right, and he really tailed off later, but as his role changed because they had Niedermeyer. But you know, like I said, Larry Robinson was an incredible offensive defenseman, and but certainly he's in the Hall of Fame. Like I said, Rod Langway, and yeah, there will be stay-at-home defensemen. Guys like Stevens who will get in, but it will be harder because the other guys can do so much. And as the game opens up now, the stay-at-home defenseman is going to have a little less value, and this guy who can make a play and jump in the play and score, his value will increase, which is good, I think. The talented should shine through.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's a great segue into the way I wanted to kind of finish up here, is I was going to ask you, since, like I said, a lot of my listeners may or may not be sports fans, you're more qualified probably than anyone else. I was going to give you a chance to sell our sport, you know, our beloved hockey, on maybe on non-sports fans, and you know, tell non-sports fans why hockey is the first one they should try and get into, and then also maybe even tell baseball and football fans why they should give hockey another chance.
Yeah, I've written a lot about this in my column, and certainly can go archive that and see a lot of different viewpoints. But some of the ones I've touched on throughout the years, one of my litmus tests is when go watch 7-year-olds play baseball, go watch them play football, go watch them play basketball, go watch them play hockey. And I guarantee you, you'll be more entertained by the 7-year-old hockey game than any other of the sports by far. And to me, that slowly is the case as they get older and older. A high school hockey game is way more exciting than a high school baseball game. Certainly there are some levels of high school football and high school basketball that could be obviously very exciting. But go to an NFL game and realize how long you sit there and nothing happens, whether it's the incredibly long TV timeouts or how a play takes 5 seconds and then takes 35 till you run another one. And just the pace, and to me, I'm just bored to tears when I go to an NFL game. And I like NFL football. I grew up an NFL fan. It's not like I'm a hater.
Right.
But the hockey just never stops. It goes up and down. And then when you get involved in the culture and your kids play and you're around it and you're around NHL players, like I'm lucky enough to be a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, and you realize what good people they are and the courage it takes to play the game and the unselfishness and how that culture really does permeate throughout the whole sport. And when you're, like I said, it's just great for the kids in terms of fitness and teamwork and skill. And it's just, and like I said, just the culture of being around the rink and being inside in a cold winter's day for those of us who live in cold climates and driving around the games. It's just a neat little culture, and it really is. To me, I really do kind of compare it to whether it's a musical culture you might be involved in or people who like to go to little small used bookstores or whatever. And to me, it's a nice little culture. It seems like there's not a lot of those around, and they're all little jewels, and I think hockey is one of those.
Yeah, that's very, very well said. And you know, that makes, just in response to what you said, I think I'd never really realized it until I was just listening to you just there. I mean, I definitely want hockey to grow and get huge again, but at the same time, I would miss that aspect of it if it became as big as the NFL.
Yeah, that's actually the topic of my column today. I talked about how everyone at ESPN over the weekend was watching the NCAA basketball tournament, and I was the only one watching the NCAA hockey tournament. and how, you know, the Villanova-Florida game was just an awful game where everyone missed every shot. It was played in a huge cavernous Metrodome that was 85% full. The action is 1,000 feet from everybody watching the game. On TV, Jim Nantz and Billy Packer were about to fall asleep. I thought they were going to be attack with narcolepsy at any moment. They were so bored. And I'm watching this great hockey game in Green Bay, Wisconsin, between Wisconsin and Cornell in a nice cozy arena where the fans are right on top of it, triple overtime, edgier seat hockey, nonstop. And I'm thinking, this is great. And like you said, if it were to get big, that game would be played in the Metrodome. And I don't want that to be played in the Metrodome. I want to, you know, hockey and music are a lot alike. The more intimate, the better the concert, the better the game. And those people who got to see U2 in 1980 in a small club in Boston, it was a way better deal than those who saw U2 in the Fleet Center in 2006 in Boston. Yeah, it was a good show, but nothing like 1980 when you think about, boy, this band has promise, and they're young, and they're 21 years old, and they have all this energy, and boy, there's something special. These guys could be big, and it's intimate. You're 20 feet from them. You can see their sweat, and you can smell them, and that's a better show than playing in the Bruins ATM machine in front of 20,000 people. And it's the same with hockey.
And I think that's a good way to leave off here. And I want to thank you so much for being on, John Buccigross, and hopefully we converted a couple of people. Everyone, you know, get OLN, watch hockey when it's on, and NBC, watch it wherever you can. It's a great sport. And thank you so much. And yeah, absolutely. Go to ESPN.com and the NHL page and find John Buccigross's column. It's a
every click goes to charity. It's for the children.
That's okay.
Not real. So there's a good archive section of all my columns. I do a couple of columns on Travis Roy, the kid who was paralyzed on his first college shift at Boston University when he went headfirst to the boards. And I just, like you said, I talk about a lot of different things, not just hockey.
Right.
And I know there's some people, I do read it, even though they aren't hockey fans, which is nice. Although I definitely, the purpose is for people who like hockey and like other things. And I always thought there was a bit of a hole there in U.S. in terms of a column where people kind of go to and just really love, from a fan perspective, who has a little bit of contact with players in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And I just doesn't come off as a name dropper just because I am also a journalist. And I want to also inform the people and talk to the players and talk to the people in the league. And so I kind of walk that fine line, and I hope, and that's always my goal to do that.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for being on. And everyone, check out John Buccigross's book when it comes out, and the ESPN column, and check him out on ESPN. He's on SportsCenter. And you are doing the Thursday night thing with Barry Melrose. Or you're going
ESPN
to be.
ESPN News every Thursday, yep.
Yeah.
And then between 10 and 11, we visit with Barry a couple times. Highlights on one segment and usually issues on the other segment. So for those who lost NHL tonight and the 40 million or so homes who have ESPN News on every Thursday night, you can see a little taste of it with actually me, usually it's me, Barry, and Bill Pito, the both NHL Tonight's hosts throughout the years.
Cool. Then everyone needs to check that out. And thanks for being on, John. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Okay, see, I told you he was an interesting guy. Okay, only two last things left to do here. First, I got one other donation. I don't know if the person wants me to say their name aloud, so I'll say thank you. You know who you are. And if you want me to, then get in touch with me, and I'll say your name. I'll give you a personal thanks next time. And everyone else, feel free to donate. You see the donate button on the sidebar at www.jackmangan.com. Every little bit helps. Okay, I'm going to leave you off this week with a song that I recorded back around the year 2000 with Matt Mango, Steve Fernandez, and Pat Catino. It's a song called Cool Cats. It will sound familiar to all fans of Duel of the Fates. And personally, I really like this song a lot, and I don't really understand why more people weren't naked in the streets over it. It's got a great groove, and I hope you like it too. Now for your listening pleasure, Cool Cats. And that's the end of Jack Mangan's Deadpan number 4. Thanks for listening. Please donate. And come back next week for an interview with author Scott Sigler. Peace out, homies.